Hi, this is Katrina, and this is Zooming in the Lens podcast. It's adventures of spiritual dialogue with us from the streets of rock and roll into the shifts of perceptions. We hope Zooming in the Lens can bring us all together, sharing the stuff of life and practice, suffering and grace. And we're really grateful to all of you who might be listening to our rants with compassion and curiosity. For more information, visit us at functionalyogaonline.com. Hey, this is Katrina with Zooming in the Lens podcast. And I think we're on number 14, I think. Did I say 14? Or 15? I think it's 14. Whatever, wherever we are, whatever we're doing, maybe we're on podcast 1000. I don't remember, but that's not really what's important. I'm here with my fellow Satsang member, Kara Evans, who you'll remember from a podcast or two ago that she was on here with her mom, Rena, Rena Joy, and she was on the podcast where we were talking a lot about what it is she does in the psychic world, and she's come up with her own way to read tarot cards. Very interesting. I really enjoyed having Rena on, and I wanted to have Kara on again because of a recent conversation we had. Welcome, Kara Evans.
Hi. So happy to be here again. Sharing our thoughts and feelings, topics, and rantings.
Rantings, yes. Rantings they are. I was going through my quotes the other day, and I found this quote that I wanted to share with everybody. I know we're going to definitely discuss who the originator of this quote is, but just for now, to read the quote, I'll say it's by Eleanor Roosevelt. Yes, Eleanor Roosevelt, who I really dug for a multitude of reasons. Number one, for her civil rights work. And, you know, she was married to Franklin D. Roosevelt, our president. And she kind of stood up for herself, even against him, with certain issues, which you don't really hear a lot of these days, do you?
She was a woman before her time, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, she's done a real lot for the African and Asian communities and women's rights. Anyway, so she said this great quote that I have been debating and interpreting in my own way and reading a lot of different people's points on it. And it sparked an interest between you and I to sort of do a podcast about getting small and average and great. So I don't know, unless we change our mind by the end of it, the name of the podcast should probably be Let's Get Small, Average, and Great. So what do I mean by that? If you don't already know this quote, great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, and small minds discuss people. So, yes, to whoever that might have angered, I don't know what their perception of that quote is, but I'm looking at it in a much more balanced way, not in a way of great minds are necessarily better, or that small minds are insulting somebody and saying that they have no intelligence. I mean, there's lots of ways that you can look at this, but if we're looking at this, to me, I'm looking at this more from maybe a cry for us to switch and shift our perception. So, Kara, tell me about and tell everybody about what you were telling me first before we pontificate people to death. What you found out about this quote being by Eleanor Roosevelt?
Well, the first most interesting thing I found out is that the quote actually is not by Eleanor Roosevelt, and that somehow she got credited with saying it, but after investigation, there was never any truth found to that, nor could that quote be traced back to her.
Isn't that interesting?
She has many quotes. She's written books and said some fantastic things, but that does not seem to be one of them. The theories are that this particular quote or versions of it have been traced back to Socrates. And the first actual noted version of the quote was by Charles Stewart in an autobiography. He didn't actually quote it. He wrote in his book that he published in 1901 that he was listening to a dinner, a conversation that took place at a dinner by Henry Thomas Buckle, who said a very similar quote to what you said, but when it was first quoted, it was a little bit different. They said men and women range themselves into three class orders of intelligence. You can tell the lowest class by their habit of always talking about persons, the next by the fact that their habit is always to converse about things, and the highest by their preference for the discussion of ideas. And that things change to events somehow over 100 and some odd years of this particular concept evolving, being requoted, restated, attributed and credited to different people and no people, anonymous and, you know, over time people said, reflected on the quote and then gave the credit to an unknown sage was one of the right. credits by Rickover, but there were many of them, but interesting that none of them actually were Eleanor Roosevelt.
Well, I wonder, is that interpretation that you read, is he saying that the meaning is that great minds means intelligence? So he's basing it on intelligence.
He's saying that, yes, he's actually putting people in social classes in that particular statement, that the highest social classes
right.
are people that have the ability to discuss ideas.
Right, right. So he's, okay. So, but this is not the originator of it. That's just an interpretation of it.
Right. It's the first one they found in print, right. so to speak, that they could prove, whoever they is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Us and they. Right.
Google is they.
Yeah, Google is they in 1901, exactly. Well, I mean, I have a very, very different interpretation. I don't think it's about who's right or who's wrong, because especially what I love about what you're saying is that we will never know. It's so similar to a lot of other things that we study. And is it really important that we know? You know, knowing is a mind's job, and it's so linear because knowing is just all of us getting together and finding some proof, which obviously we've talked about in these podcasts. That proof then changes, like smoking with the windows rolled up and your kids in the back is perfectly fine. That changed. So who's right or wrong is not really important. I think us, you know, engaging in interpreting things that have come throughout the years, wisdom that have been shared. I find a lot of wisdom in this quote because I didn't see it as that. And when I got on the internet, yes, I got on the internet and I looked at people's interpretations of this. I found this one website where this guy just said something that I just cracked up laughing. Let me read it to you. About this. I mean, they were all on there saying similar to things as to what I'm asking you about, which is this pointing to intelligence. And this gentleman, I only know he's a gentleman because he says that in the description of himself, which I'm not reading to you. This is what he says. I've always thought of it as pretentious navel gazing, personally. It's the sort of thing that only the kind of person who fancies themselves in the first category would say. And for whatever reason, most of the people I've met who claim to have something along the lines of a great mind are slightly above average at best. The ones I know who truly do have incredibly powerful minds, though, they don't bother with insulting other people's intellect with sideways comments like this. Suffice it to say, I think it's exactly the kind of horseshit that Reddit just loves. Whoa. I mean, I found that to open up a line with pretentious navel gazing, and then he goes on to say that this is just, you know, people that are resonating with the first line, which is great minds discuss ideas. Like, this is just a bunch of pretentious bullshit is basically what he's saying. But to use the line pretentious navel gazers, which I had to look up because it's the second time this week, ironically, a client of mine was describing something, not something of mine, thank God. Although listen, as far as I'm concerned, I must be a pretentious navel gazer then, because I mean, firstly, I'm not aligning myself with the first one by any means. I read his and I was just as shocked as when you read me the interpretation you just read to all of us, because I took this more to mean, actually, I interpreted it a couple of ways, that in our culture, we're looking at the word great mind as the best thing you could be. And I didn't look at it as being anything that was economically judged or notoriety driven. I didn't look at it like you have to, you know, to have a great mind, like all the people, the quotes that we're reading, and we say they have a great mind. You know, those are the people that are notorious for what they're doing. They're legends in what they're doing. So people say, wow, he had a really great mind. But to me, great is not just limited to that. Great is also wide. Like, imagine in a spacious way. You have wide vision and you can discuss ideas. Why can you discuss ideas? Because there's no one idea. Maybe there's many, and so the wide-visioned person, which nobody's saying that wide vision is what you want or don't want, but wide vision is somebody that can pontificate on many different ideas. It doesn't say idea, it says ideas. It's plural. And it kind of is asking us to be creative and imaginative. And I think we were talking about earlier, it's 50,000 to 70,000 thoughts a day that we have as human beings. And I remember hearing from somebody who I can't quote, but it is not my line at all, but that we have barely one original thought a day. And I might even be giving us some more grace than is actually quoted by this person. Imagine we have no original thoughts a day. Now, he wasn't saying this to mean that, although it could be, that we all are one and we're all sharing thoughts all together. And because you've never heard anybody say it, you think you have an original thought. I interpreted it as, but it's not limited to, that whatever we're thinking right now usually is a thought we had the day before, or the day before, or when you were 20, or 15, or 10, or 5, whatever it is, that we aren't having original thoughts of ourselves. So everything is kind of regurgitated through us, and filtered, and then forgotten and re-said. Whether that's true or not is not really the important part. I find that interesting as an idea. So if a great mind can also be that you're wide and you're letting lots of different things in out of the 50 and 70,000 thoughts that you have per day. I'm not saying that you're having 10 original thoughts because you have a great mind. And then the average mind I sort of looked at as it could be a satisfied mind. Somebody who's satisfied and doesn't really want for more. Is happy where they are, or maybe not happy, but satisfied, because happy is a place to land. And I know satisfying could be looked at as a place to land, but they're doing their dharma. They're doing, you know, what they culturally have been born into. And work is making a living, and having to do a job is something we're culturally born into as humans.
Maybe they settled for what they have.
Yeah, but doesn't settle feel like it's not great? Like you're settling. Maybe that's my, you know, not thinking wide. Maybe that's me not thinking wide. The word settled means that. Maybe the word settled could be a great thing.
Well, they're
thing.
Happy. I just mean they're happy with where they are. They're not looking to expand into the greatness or the vastness of other possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make them good or bad. It just makes them have what they have and be okay with what they have.
Right, right.
And not really question, is there more?
Right.
Because we know just from our studies and our practice that you could just keep on knowing and keep on growing, and that's endless. So doesn't that make us have great minds in that sense, that you just want to know and learn and observe and definitely ponder all different possibilities and not just say, okay, this is what it is. This is good. I'm good.
Right. And it changes.
And I know a lot of people like that. So
I don't know a lot of people that are just satisfied, you know, like, I mean, really, how many people do you know that say, no, I don't want a different job, or no, I don't want a raise, or I don't want this, or I don't want that. When you look at the word, you know, what she said here, whoever said, average minds discuss events. I mean, we'll get to what they're discussing in a minute. But, you know, first looking at the different ways that we could translate the descriptions of the minds is, I think, the first interpretation that is kind of fun to look at. So average would be something that people are desiring, right? I mean, these are just, it's widening our vision a little bit to not take things so literally, because to me, literal just could also mean a word that Sass used to use all the time, programming, which I never fully liked because it made me feel like I was literally a robot, even though I know I am a robot. Obviously, I'm hung up on that, but it denotes that it's what the majority is doing. In that line of thinking, that we're, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say average. They use the word average. In itself, it's just the median. It's the middle of the road. It's the...
Yes.
It's the median. That's the best word that I could use for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's just expanding and not just taking, not hearing something, which we all do, and the mind will grab onto a memory of what that has meant or what it might denote it in past time. So then basically all we're living today is the past. Every time somebody says something to us, we're putting it in a place that is not an original thought. It's something either rehashed from others or from our past or both, you know. So then, you know, with small, you know, I sort of started playing with the word minds too a little bit and making it. What did I say? It wasn't mindfulness. It was.
Small-mindedness.
Mindedness. Yeah, I think it was mindedness. I mean, I'm not even offended by mindfulness, but I was looking at small, again, in a spacious way, as being like neat and tidy and focused. So think of the word focus. Maybe the small part of this could be that there are people that focus on what's right in front of them right there and not in the past or in the future, but right what's in front of them, the farmer that doesn't really know much about anything else going on, but they have to get the crops done. They have to till the soil. These are things that they do in their life to expand their world. That's expanding. It's not just the notoriety and the financial status that makes somebody be able to say something is great or small, especially in a quote like this. I just can't imagine limiting it to it being size, because you and I both know that size is not what really matters.
Correct.
I mean, yes, I will go so far to say that I have met really beautiful men that have, you know, been very great and large in size. Shut your ears if you're a child. And it literally means nothing unless you know what you're doing with the greatness.
And of the mind.
Of the mind. That's kind of sexist, Tara. Right. I mean, don't some people call that part of the man the small mind?
The small mind.
Yes. Okay. So,
wow.
The men out there, right? Do you think small mind is a bad thing? If you're talking, I mean,
no.
You wouldn't want it to mean that if we were talking about it in that context. So, rethink it. That's what I got to say. Because size, you know, it really doesn't matter. Because, like I said, gorgeous man, great in size, opens his mouth. And ignorance comes out, and, you know, that tight sort of hold on concepts and roles and models. I don't care how gorgeous you are or how great your mind is.
Other mind.
I'm going to pass. I'm probably going to pass. So that's a little hint out there to all you men. Size doesn't really matter. It's, what do they say, that old, it's the motion of the ocean? Yeah.
Things we find out first.
Exactly. And large, right? Large doesn't always mean smarter and bigger and better, like the elephant and the whale's brains, right? You were reading something to me about the cognition, was it?
Right, that the intelligence and cognitive level of our size of our brains is not directly related to our ability, because elephants and whales have larger brains in size. So
right.
They disprove the theory that the larger the brain, the more intelligent the being.
Right. The being, get it? Yeah, so what happens when you rethink that quote from that place? And I think the really important part here is to say that I don't think that anywhere in this did they say great minds only discuss ideas and great minds only discuss events and small minds only discuss people. I think what this quote is describing is all the qualities that each of us possess and use all the time. All of us have moments of expansion. All of us have moments, some longer than others, of feeling satisfied. I mean, it's a great thing to feel average and small in this interpretation, and in spirituality as well. Because, you know, spirituality at its core really doesn't have anything to do with the mind. So I think that in understanding even something that we speak about a lot on this podcast is cultivating the witness, developing that other part of you, even though it's so alluring and it feels like we're coming out of our everything we're seeing out of our eyes, you know, everything feels like it's very much coming from us, out of our eyes, out of our mouth. You use your hand and it feels like it's really you. We all have that. So being in the discussions of what it is like to cultivate the witness, I think it runs simultaneous to our personality, to our twos, as I describe, the Katrina two is what we think and feel, and our personalities are part of that. That's a system within it. And they run simultaneous. It's not that you cultivate the witness, you cultivate the part of you that could witness a thought to get rid of your two, to be in place of your two. It's not about that. It's about it running simultaneously. So like in the meditations, I think we talked about in one of the podcasts with your mother, when you sit and meditate, it's not about controlling the mind or getting rid of the mind. Even when we feel like I can't meditate because my mind won't stop, what's it like if you just let your mind go and you watch where it's going and you notice there's the thought about needing to scratch an itch. There's the thought about work tomorrow. And that part of you that's witnessing that isn't looking at the mind as something that it has to get rid of. So in that way of them running simultaneous within us is what I think this quote is talking about. The moments when we can notice now, when am I having discussions about people and what part of me, what's my intention for discussing people? Like, think about it in just a negative way in culture, right? We'll go back to the other side of this quote, how maybe that man took it. And think how many friends that you have that are speaking, how many times we, all of us, can get on a conversation, into a conversation with somebody, talking about what the neighbor did or what your mother did or what your father did. And how does that make you feel? We all use that excuse that we're just venting, but you're taking on that emotion that you're talking about. If you're frustrated, if you're angry with somebody, you talk about it. You talk about these people in your life and your body takes on that role. I mean, check out your posture when you do things like that. Who is it helping? It feels momentarily like it's helping you to vent. But if you looked at the science for this, you see that that's stored memories and you're basically living it over and over again. Now, to me and somebody in my practice, I let in the bad with the good because that's life, right? You're always having the yin and the yang, the light and the dark. You can't know one without the other. So I'm not trying to change whether I talk about people or not. I'm trying to witness what happens in my body when I do. And it's interesting when we're the creators of the ones talking about the people. When you're the creator of that, or maybe you're not in the mood to talk about people and somebody calls you up, or you hear gossip while you're on the subway, and you judge them for gossiping. We're just as bad when we judge the people talking about people.
Is gossip?
Say it again.
You know the term small talk?
Yeah.
I think that's right along lines with the small minds talking about people, because I feel like, and I do it and I've done it, from time to time when you're in an uncomfortable situation with a stranger, the old stuck in the elevator with someone and you have that awkward silence and you always break the silence with something, either something, some person that, you know, maybe was just in the elevator or in the news or a TV show or the weather or, you know, just little small talk so that it's not so awkward. Or you're speaking with somebody that you don't really have anything in common with, or you're left in a room with an in-law that you don't like. You just always find something to talk about. It's like mindless chatter. Yeah. That's how that resonated with me. And we talked about stories before, and nothing came to mind. But now that I thought about that, I realized not too long ago that my first husband had nothing to say to anybody. He only spoke to people about gossip in the news, sports and sporting events that were happening, but not about the event or nothing really interesting about it. But, you know, hey, how about that Jeter, you know? And later on, people said things to me like, yeah, well, he, you know, he never had anything to say. We never had a conversation about anything relevant. And, you know, I don't have to really go into the type of person except to say small-minded, small talk, you know, very limited scope of interest level or depth of human being. And there are people like that. We all have it in us to an extent and use it in certain situations when we need to, but we don't live it. It is a multitude of the small, the average, and the great that makes us interesting.
We're almost asleep in it. I think that's why these kinds of quotes are great to talk about. Because at one, you know, in a day, I can move from discussing ideas to discussing events to discussing people in a day. So it's not pointing at which one is better. It is if that's your perception of it. Basically, it's about perception, right? That guy's perception was that this is pretentious navel-gazing because you're making one person better than somebody else and saying that all people that discuss people are small-minded. But it doesn't make any sense to observe it like that. It seems completely linear to look at this as a bad and a good. And there's many more things that I can use as examples, but I know I don't want to get too wrapped up in this, but there's we all have this tendency to want to sit somewhere in a belief, in an interpretation, in a methodology, in a clique or a circle of friends, or I know what I am, I'm the one who talks about events because I talk about events all the time. Like, what I'm saying is we all have the same feelings. There is nobody better and nobody worse. That's the us and them. And people do bad things. People do good things. But if you hang your hat on the things you do, we become and maybe are, and there's elements of that in all of us, always striving to get somewhere than appreciating where we're actually at. So in a way, if we can look at ourselves in every one of those lines, that alone is broadening us to then not feel like everything said has to be taken so personally. And as we get that space with cultivating the witness and being able to notice what we think and notice, oh, wow, I noticed that I'm discussing people today and what's my intention behind that and am I feeling shitty today so I want to make other people feel shitty. I mean, I still can't wrap my head around this very plain and simple form of communication, mostly between women. It's the conversation where I call up somebody or somebody calls me, because I'm definitely not out of the equation. Hi, how are you? And we respond with the litany of shit that has gone on in our day. Well, first I woke up, and then when I did this, this happened, and then I got outside, and the car was covered with snow, and so I had to peel all the snow off, and then I had to drive, and there was an accident. And when I got there, of course, I was late, and so then I got in trouble from my boss. And then to make matters worse, like, and it goes on and on. Whenever I do that, I never go, phew, wow, I'm glad I got that off my chest. Never. I never did prior to practicing, and I don't now. It's just that then I never really took anybody else into consideration. I never thought, oh, I just dumped a load of shit on somebody. Never. It occurred to me. But through practice, through noticing how I'm showing up in every moment, by realizing it's not about sitting in one place, it's about being in all places at all times and also being able to broaden my thinking that all of it is just a part of being in human incarnation. It's not, it's the witnesser, the observer of the things that I think and feel and the thoughts and what I do with my body and how I move. It's from that place that I try to find the lightness of the moment. Because when I move into the witnesser, I can laugh about the fact that I just verbally threw up all over somebody, my shitty day. And through practice, I now realize that if I've never said, oh, I'm so glad I vented, I feel better, with no conclusion, mind you, it's just a conversation of me throwing up on somebody. If I've never felt better, and now with practice, I realize that person is not gaining a thing from me throwing up all over them. If anything, they probably won't call me again for a while. Mm-hmm. So then there's nobody that is really gaining much of anything. If it made me feel better, I absolutely have friends, you being one of them, that will say, let your two vent. Vent, get it out, and then we'll hang up. And because we've had that awareness with each other, that this is a moment in time and there's no judgment on it, that we're releasing energy and it is a release of energy, and I can have that thought of, wow, I really do feel better. I can do the work on why the hell that makes me feel better. And you can hold space for yourself as the listener to not let that infiltrate your psyche, because you're building up that witness enough that you're just being there for me as a friend. You're just holding space as a friend. But without that practice, there's a lot of stuff coming at you and a lot of stuff you're throwing out at people.
Well, that's a whole... That topic is a whole other discussion, because...
I don't think it is. I think that is what great minds discuss ideas. Like, there's an idea that my personality is having this boom, 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 shitty day. That's an idea. It's my perception and their ideas. Because maybe if you look at somebody in a third world country, they would think that was a pretty fabulous day because I wasn't scrounging for food and having to clean up the feces of my villagers.
But what I'm saying is the person that's spewing out that bullshit, you know, that dumping of their entire day on the asker, needs to have the wherewithal to know where you can throw up and where you can't throw up.
Well, you know what? I'm going to disagree with you. Here's why. I disagree with you because I think it's none of our business whether they have the wherewithal or not. That's their business, their problem. But it is my business to cultivate my practice, whatever it is you're sitting in, to be able to learn. Because if it's not that person, it's going to be somebody else, or it's going to be a job. How to hold space for myself in moments like that, where you know this, because we've talked about this in our friendship, when you're driving in the car with somebody and they're driving and they're have road rage and your stomach turns as the passenger because you're on your way to do something that's, you know, we're perceiving as great and we want to just have a great time, but this person's totally stressed out. And what happens when you don't hold your own space is that everything will get to you. And so the great times to practice are moments like that. If I can learn to hold my space, then anybody can call me. And if I think that person should know that they shouldn't do that, I'm constantly looking at other people to make my life better. And really, it's my fucking problem. Have I mastered it? Not a chance. Do I practice it? Absolutely. And that's the other thing too, is this whole alternative thinking and wisdom and Eastern philosophy, that's not deemed as better either. It's a place where we can witness. I keep saying that word because honestly, I don't have a better word for it. Noticing how we're showing up in the world. It's not just about giving my friends what they need. It's not just about, you know, oh, I want to be a great person, so I'm going to do great things to be that great person. Besides the great person definition being relative, it's being with what is, what actually is in that moment. And what is in that moment might be a small mind discussing people, average discussing events, great minds discussing ideas. I might be any one of those at any given moment, but when we're asleep, we want to look at this quote as being about better, what's better and what's worse. And then that makes the us and the them. To me, in my perception of it, I'm trying to take responsibility only for my part. And I do have people in my life that will probably never change and never not call me up and run their litany of horrible events from their day. So if it wasn't those people, like I said, it would be others. I think that's why this is all talking about the same thing. There's that guy's perception of this quote. There's your perception of the quote and my perception of the quote. The one that serves me in my practice might not be the one that serves you. But what I'm saying is that we're trying to seek balance in all of these and knowing that the mind is not really what we're going for. So can you notice when you're and what is your intention behind discussing and gossiping about people? What's your intention behind discussing events? And what's your intention to discussing ideas? Because if your intention and your motivation behind discussing ideas is to be thought of as smart and intelligent, that's not the right intention. Maybe it is for you, it's not for me. I don't want to discuss and pontificate about ideas because I want people to think I'm smart. And if I do have that intention, you can bet your ass that I'm witnessing it and I will definitely be practicing it. Only you know out there why you're saying something. Do you want to be seen? Do you want to be heard? Are you discussing ideas because you think that's what you're supposed to be discussing? Because now somebody says that that's what great minds are and you want to be a great mind. Listen, we're all on the same boat. We're all feeling like phonies and fakes through so much of a part of our life. It's not really, if you're aligning yourself with only the mind, that's really going to affect you. I say, yes, we are all fakes and phonies at points of our life. If you're more worried about being a fake and a phony than actually noticing the thoughts that you're fake and phony, it's going to be a harder road to get to what your true intentions really are. So to me, that's what the definition of showing up is. And I just found this quote to be taking you down that road, right, of this conversation we're having. Because I think interpretation is huge.
Everything.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What you find is beautiful might not be what I find beautiful. So what's great, what's average, and what's small? If you want to listen to what society is saying about those definitions, that's one perception. I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm not saying that I don't. But I at least, I don't know about you, Kara, but I feel better when I hear things that are telling me that it's not very often that we have an original idea. That makes me feel like, great, there's somewhere else I get to practice. Because not that I'm overanalyzing thoughts, that's a completely different game, one that can actually help in lots of arenas, but it's a different method. But to be able to then notice the next time that I have that thought, that I'm in that place, and not being so hard on myself because I'm showing up in that way, but understanding that that is part of the human condition. I'm just like everybody else, and we're all just like Ram Dass or Socrates or Thich Nhat Hanh or all these people, and our neighbor and our mother and our father. We all have these thoughts. The thoughts, they melt away. Like, they start to melt away. My desire to talk about people just sorts of melts away. But I don't judge people that are doing it. I didn't read this quote and think, oh, yeah, those small-minded people. I don't know. I don't consider myself a power of positive thinker either. And I don't know. You know what? I don't really mind if I am a pretentious navel gazer.
It's hard to turn off our judgmental mind, too.
I say don't try to turn it off.
Yeah.
Just have it.
Just have it.
Just have it. What's it like to be judgmental, and the part of you that can look in on the judgmental thoughts, just being with that could be a lifetime practice. And it is for many people whose quotes you're reading on Facebook that you think are famous philosophers and great thinking minds. There's that great again. How do you think they know what they're quoting about? Because they too are in that place, and maybe days they are without it and they can think in a wider way. Maybe some days they're thinking in a more focused way, and so they get out another kind of a thought. Embrace all of it. I want to stop being so hard on ourselves, on myself, of trying to categorize my thinking into those sort of limited ways. If you are a pretentious navel gazer, be happy and, you know, proud of your pretentious navel gazing, and then go inside and find the truth to that for you by looking at what the intention is. I don't pontificate ideas because I want to be the one person who's had an original thought. You don't even think about those sorts of things. And if you do, then look at the intention behind it. You have anything else you want to say about that quote? I mean, we talked forever on that quote. I totally did not mean that.
No, the only last thing that I want to say is on the great mind side, if we didn't already point it out, is that great minds that think great things are not necessarily always good things.
Societally good things, right.
Societally good things. Good That's decisions, true. Good outcomes. It doesn't mean that the mind that thought it or the task that they figured out wasn't great, something great to overcome in terms of its complexity or its vastness, but detrimental, horrible outcomes, including our country and being in debt and going to war and That's all right. of those things.
That's a really great point, Kara. It's true. Because it all depends on who in you is looking at that event, that idea. If the you of the mind is looking at it, you might think differently than if you were thinking from your heart. Metaphorically. So yeah, there's greatness in the good and the bad, because ideas are just ideas. But isn't all of life one giant idea? How did the telephone get discovered? It was an idea. How did we become homes with, you know, 2.1 family and the white picket fence? It was an idea. An idea that you want to be an engineer. It's an idea. Even passions, they're still an idea.
And there are ideas that are not acted upon.
That's right.
So.
That's right.
And those things we might never know.
That's right. Yeah, I was thinking about the second parts of this, you know, and in regards to the ideas, the events, and people. And in the people one, like small minds discuss people, I was thinking about the way that we relate to each other. And Ram Dass has something called the channels. And it was really inspiring to me when I studied this and continually do. It's a way in which we see people. So imagine that there's a channel you could be on where when we look at others, all we're seeing is the physical body, short, fat, tall, or thin. We're describing them subconsciously or consciously, debating what the word conscious even means. We're not aware that we're not looking back in at our thought. So we're just seeing people. We all do it. Going to a supermarket and you're food shopping and you're seeing people as shapes. And the mind is chattering, oh, that's a short person, or that person's fat, or that person's tall, or that person's thin. So that's the physical realm. Like, it is channel one. And then channel two is seeing everybody as personalities, like social rules and the judgments that we have of them. It's identifying our roles. So like daughter, man, banker, son, wife, singer, party planner. So then we're, you know, how many times have you been out where we're noticing somebody for their physical body in channel one, then we get to talking to them. And some of the first things people ask, especially in LA, is what do you do for a living? Oh, I'm an engineer, I'm a banker, I'm a Hollywood director. And so the channel two is that we're seeing people in their personalities and their and our judgments of them. So their social roles. And the first two are sort of identifying with the body, and that's where most of the suffering happens in us as humans, is on those first two channels. Because in ourselves, if we feel fat, or if we feel like we just lost the greatest job of our life, these are things that could be taken away from us. They're things that are ever-changing. They're the stuff that makes you have what you think is your life, is our life as humans, our job, what we look like, what class we're in, what role we have, and then all the models that we pick in life to support that. And then we have a reaction from that if we don't have it anymore. And then the third channel, so you flip the switch. Ram Dass talks about flipping the channel like you have a cable box, or these are actually network channels like channel 2, channel 4, channel 7. We don't even have cable yet. And the third one is the astral plane, where everybody's identifying themselves by their astrological sign. But at least you're out of the physical realms of channel 1 and 2. You're now seeing past that. And you're saying, oh, well, the reason why you're like that is because you're a Gemini and your rising moon is Aquarius. So that makes total sense. So then we can form a judgment on that person based on the time and the year they were born. Then you flip it one more channel to channel five. I'm sorry, channel four. And this is a practice of when you look at another being and you see that that being looks just like you behind it. Now, I know that's like, what? How I started practicing this was, it's easier with strangers for me. is that I would walk into the supermarket. I find a lot of spiritual practice in the supermarket, but I do. And if I saw somebody that my mind would judge, I simply used my imagination, which we all have, and I put my head on their body. Now, that's not exactly what Ram Dass is talking about here. He's speaking in a much deeper way, but in an elementary beginner's way for me. I put my head on their body and I saw myself with that judgment. So say it's somebody too skinny or somebody too fat, whatever that is. I would feel horrible if somebody was looking at me and thinking that way. That's on one level, right? But on the deeper level, in that oneness, I can see myself in that other person because the circumstances we have all felt of maybe somebody's judging us, maybe somebody's looking at us and feeling like we're too old or too female or too male or too this or too that, too bald, too much hair, whatever. Every human has felt that at one time or another. So I take those feelings that they boil down to of not feeling good enough, and I put my head on them and I can see myself in them. And that immediately makes me feel, because we are a narcissistic culture, right? Myself. And it makes me feel compassion. And I can feel compassion both for me and for the person. And it allows me to better witness the judgment. Does it mean the judgment will go away? At that point, I've already stopped looking for a result. I don't need the result. I'm not thinking about the result. Because if I go for the result of it, of like, well, what does that do for you? Most likely, we would never, ever practice or try to self-study in much of any way. Because it would be just about what the mind is telling you you are. So that's channel four. Ram Dass says this great bit when he talks about channel four that I do with my niece. We look at each other in the eyes and we say, how did you get in there? I'm in here. Wow. Can you see me? I can see you. And what we're really saying is like, you're me and I'm you. Now I can say that to her because we're so close, but I can still do it when we're arguing. Seeing myself in others. And that really helps with the us and them disease that we all have going. I love my family. I love my car. I love my eye, everything. And that disease is what is attributing to a lot of our suffering. We're seeing everybody else as separate, except for the ones that we've deemed deserves our love because they share our blood or they share a father or a mother. But there's a lot of people out there who identify with their soul feeling more love for people that are not related to them by blood.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can feel that.
You can totally feel that. And I know many people, you don't choose your family and your blood. They're just brought here and into your life, into your soul group, into your family. It doesn't mean you have to like them.
No, but that's a big social hang-up, man. You know, I mean, it's hard. We're all told that we have to love our family. And what that translates to is you have to communicate with me, and you end up communicating like you did when you were little. So that's when they say, if you think you're spiritual, go spend a week with your family.
Yes.
Because they bring you back. They don't bring you. You're going. You do have the ability to not show up like that, but most of us are showing up in our old roles and models, and that's why we don't like it, because we think we've grown, and our family won't acknowledge that growth for whatever, you know, their business is their business. There's a lot of reasons why that would happen. And so it doesn't mean your family is bad. It doesn't mean that you don't love them and keep them in your heart. But just because you share blood doesn't mean that you stop cultivating. That's really loud, whatever you're doing there. Sorry, everybody. It doesn't mean that you don't have to cultivate a relationship. And that's what we tend to do in family. You know, how many times do you find sisters or a mother and a daughter saying, you know what? I want to actually be friends with you at this point. You're 30, I'm 50. Let's try to actually cultivate a friendship here. Of course you don't. That doesn't mean you have to go smoke a joint with your mother. You go as far as you want with it. You can do that. You don't have to do that. But it just means like showing up outside of your role.
Yes. Getting to know who you actually are.
Right.
And I really like that person you are. Share your thoughts. Share your ideas. Share your small, average, and great.
Absolutely, man. Yeah. I remember when I was little, my dad used to always bring me licorice when he would go into the city in New York City. That's so funny. That's narcissistic, right? Because when you live in New York, no matter where in New York, well, I guess not upstate New York, but when you live close to New York, you don't say New York City. You say the city. And when you leave the state of New York, you still say the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then people are like, oh, the city of L.A. or the city of Austin, or you're like, no, the city. Well, you know what? Newsflash, New York, it's not the city. But man, you just witnessing that, you see how, wow, we're asleep at those moments. We're, yeah, well, of course you know what I'm talking about. It's Manhattan. It's New York City. I forgot what I was talking about.
The licorice, you're
doing. Oh, yeah, yeah. Thank you. So he used to bring me licorice when he went into Manhattan, finished a session, and he would go to, they had some store there near his studio, and he would bring me it back, and I loved it. You know, I grow up to find out that mostly what I loved is that my dad was thinking of me with so many other kids. He was thinking of me in that moment, and he was bringing something that, yes, I liked licorice when I was younger. I never had the heart, you know, after my father passed away when I was 17, I would keep getting licorice from my entire family. It actually floated into some friends as well. And I never had the heart, which really just translates now to balls, I think, to tell anybody that I didn't like licorice. Yeah, that went on till I was 35 years old. And people would mail a present for my birthday or just for nothing. And there would be like Twizzlers in the package. And it got to the point where my top drawer in the kitchen was just full of licorice. I didn't like licorice anymore. And what my dad brought me wasn't Twizzlers. It was like, you know, the old fashioned, I guess. I don't really think it makes a difference. I just grew out of licorice. Well, it's sort of like that with family. And part of that is your fault, too. If you show up back as who you used to be and not allowing them to see who you are and not, I mean, you don't push it on anybody, but you try to arrive in all the dimensions of you. If we just arrive back with family, sucking our thumb and laying on the thing and saying, Mommy, cook me soup like you used to. If you can arrive as that, but also arrive as the newness of who you are and growing into, it gives somebody a chance to do that. And if they can't accept it, they can't accept it. And that's okay too. But our suffering comes when it's their inability to accept your growth. And you keep getting reminded of it because you keep going home. And so my basic belief, which is just a belief and can be changed, is that I would like to arrive in every moment, not to be, this is like actually somebody's quote, but it's something I really have an intention to work towards is caring more about arriving in the moment than being repetitive or oh God, the word just left my mind. Consistent. Caring less about being consistent with your family in this instance, and more about being in the moment. And so you arrive at your family maybe in a different moment every time. You might get locked away and called schizophrenic, I don't know, but at least you're arriving in that moment, in that what it truly is in that moment, at 15, then at 20, then at 30. And if they're willing to cultivate that in you, you can grow easier when your family is witnessing that in you. And you don't know if maybe that helps them to maybe seek that within themselves too. And it's okay if you don't, but the suffering comes from that. And that's where that quote, that's where it means a lot to me in regards to these channels of being able to switch the channels, not so you have to shed one. Okay, again, channel one, this isn't hierarchy, like the quote, channel one is not the horrible place to be. It's noticing when you're more in channel one, two, three, or four, and being able to find balance in all of them and acceptance in all of them, and just noticing when you're showing up as that. Then he talks about channel five. You know, obviously we're in cable TV now. Now we've got the satellite hookup. And channel five is looking into yourself, looking, having that look back at you. Okay, so it seems far out. The best way I could describe it is I'm looking into Kara's eyes and she stops being Kara. She stops being other. I see myself in you, and then I can see you as myself looking back at me. That's the we are one. And I know that's, you know, probably eluding a lot of people. Don't worry about it. Don't get hung up on it. You're not trying to switch channels before you actually need to. You're just noticing at any given time. I felt channel five on acid. I have had moments of channel five off of acid. I'm not striving to be anywhere. I'm just showing up, and it's nice to have these sort of diagrams to the different channels that we are. I'm sure there's many, many more channels. And he says channel six, to make the Buddhist happy, it all disappears. It's all Maya. It's all illusion. None of us are really here. And, you know, it gets continuously, you know, far out from there. But I like looking at the channels because it gives me an awareness to the different planes of existence, the different ways that we can show up. And personality is just one part of us. If you think you are only your personality, you're probably going to think you're only your mind. And all I'm saying is that whether that's true or not, nobody's come back from death and said, yeah, you know what? I took my personality with me. Nobody knows. It's about caring less about knowing and staying in that don't know mind and being more curious as to how you're actually showing up and getting diagrams from people that are on the same studies that we are, the same walk of life of, it's not self-study. That's the irony of it. It's not really self-study because the studies of self are coming from philosophies and lines of thinking that there really is no self. And the self that you think you are has very little to do with your mind. So you can't really be narcissistic in self-study if you're studying the right people, the right parts of yourself. So there maybe is no pretentious navel gazing to begin with.
Mm.
So I hope that has helped somebody just lay out a platform of, okay, well, now I'm looking at this person from a physical place. Now I'm looking at this person from what they're giving to me, and their job is great, or that their physical body is great. Or maybe I'm caring more that they're a Gemini. And maybe, you know, the point is to not get stuck in one channel.
And I wonder what that guy who wrote that, you know, obviously that's just his opinion, but he seemed to be highly offended.
Oh, you mean the guy who wrote that comment about Eleanor?
The gazer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one might look at it and say he obviously would like to think of himself as a great mind, because he cares about posting on a website, on a discussion board, and point out that somebody and somebody's theory is horseshit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't really find people that are studying these kinds of things doing that. They wouldn't really take the time to do that to point out that somebody's horseshit. I don't, I think that when you get on and say those sorts of things, you're putting people down for making one thing better and another thing worse, and you've just done that.
Exactly.
So I have this great thing that I wanted to sort of, I mean, there's more things we obviously could talk about, but I know that we're going over time. And but in regards to events or things, right, in that part of it, the average minds discuss events, I was thinking about how many times, like you were just saying about your first husband, he just wanted to talk about sporting events, right? There's a lot of ways to determine what is an event, but I also like things. People that just discuss things. And I have been watching the Republican debate and this whole Trump thing. And that's sort of what's going around in regards to events in social media, is all the quotes that this man, I mean, I'm flabbergasted that the Republican debate is like, I'm seeing it as like a game show.
Interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, the timer that usually was in place to keep people on track and be polite and allow everybody's different views and what they stand for to be heard is like a game show timer to me now, because of the things that it's like the woman that's even moderating it and Facebook is hosting it. And I mean, yes, I am being so judgmental, but I just could not believe what I was seeing. And I felt like the Republican Party would maybe be a bit embarrassed at what this has turned into. Rather than it being about the points, it's more about how crazy, what's the next crazy thing that Trump is going to say. So I know that in regards to events and people that were discussing that, I say that I'm looking at where that's coming from in me and why I expected or had any expectations at all. So I can look into my interpretation of that and why I'm thinking about Trump and judging the debate. And in regards to ideas, I think we can... I'm looking at this as striving to, or having a desire to notice how many times I've had the same thought of, you know, I'm going to be late for this, or I've got to write this, or I've got to write that. And how does it serve me to keep repeating the same things over and over again, at least in terms of, in terms of it not serving me, it not helping me in any way. And the people thing, you know, we've talked about that to death, but I love this I have it here somewhere, this quote by Hafiz. 1320 to 1325 AD. And he's a Sufi poet from the south central of Iran. Amazing, beautiful poet. If you've not heard of him, I recommend this book, The Gift, which I know Sass had recommended the translation by Daniel Ladinsky. And it's called I Have Learned So Much. I have learned so much from God that I can no longer call myself a Christian, a Hindu, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Jew. The truth has shared so much of itself with me that I can no longer call myself a man, a woman, an angel, or even a pure soul. Love has befriended Hafiz so completely, it has turned to ash and freed me of every concept and image my mind has ever known. I love it. He's talking about all of what we've been discussing. He's talking about love being the only thing that can really get us out of the labels and the roles, whether it's a religious role. It's not so much about practicing all of these things. You know you're a woman, or you know you're a man, you know you're a Jew, or you know you're a Hindu. But when it all boils down to it, Hafiz is saying that love is overtaking all of it, because it all boils down to that one thing that we all want and that we all really need to find from within ourselves. No matter what Eleanor Roosevelt or whoever said that ever meant, we will never know, because that's an anonymous quote. Just like we will never know about a lot of things in regards to philosophy and science. And so wherever we hang our hat, can we just look at where we're hanging our hat? I'm looking at where I'm hanging my hat, and slowly but surely loosening the grips of identifying myself by that which I hang it on, so that I can think and use my mind to think great, average, and small, all at the same time, without judging either one, just about noticing. So you have any last words you want to say? I talked so much tonight. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. No, I mean, we talked a lot before. I just, the concept to me, the point after dissecting and interpreting and reinterpreting, and is just that, like you said, we all have all of those things in us, and they show up at different times. Mm-hmm. And if you notice, oh yeah, that's me being small.
Yeah.
Or that's me being great.
Right.
And you're just okay with it, then, and you're not being a navel gazer.
You pretentious navel gazer.
Then it's all good.
Yeah, that's the new rule. Anybody that calls somebody a pretentious navel gazer is a pretentious navel gazer.
I mean, it's an old rule, but a new one. The definition of that was narcissistic.
Yes.
That's a very, you know, that's a big thing to call somebody. But, you know, that's a big judgment to bestow upon somebody.
Yeah, it is. It is. And listen, that's usually coming from people that think that self-study is truly really about the self. So I understand that. And if anybody has any questions about what I mean by that, they're just my, you know, my takes and my interpretations on it. But I think we should all worry less about what everybody else is doing and just try to worry about ourselves and how we're showing up in these moments, because we can't control the mind, our own, and we definitely can't control anybody else. And the only chance at change is to start noticing how we're showing up. Even when you look in the mirror, how many times a day I'll look in the mirror and my initial reaction will be to insult myself. I don't even know I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And I teach this stuff. But there is nobody that I would ever want to practice with that was telling me, yeah, I've got that. I nicked that. All somebody can really say is, I've noticed things falling away. But if you've nicked that, I'm probably going to wonder what your intentions are. Because the practice is, it's a lifestyle. It's not, it can be result-oriented. You know what? Unfortunately, it can be result-oriented. But you're going to miss so much when you're result-oriented. I mean, it's like the drive from point A to point B. It's 3 hours. And how many times have we all said, oh my God, that 3 hours just flew by. I didn't notice anything. And now we're here. Isn't that great? But those 3 hours, you missed some of the most beautiful scenery. You missed the most amazing outlet shopping. You could have stopped and bought the greatest pair of shoes for $10. You missed somebody struggling that you might want to have helped. You missed mountains and beaches. What the hell are we missing? The result-oriented is point A to point B. And you know what? The greatest result of all is the being born and being asleep our entire lives and rushing to the end. And the end, that's the end. And when you get to the end, if all you've thought about is the past and the future, and you didn't enjoy the times in between, to me, that's a pretentious navel gazer. So there. Now I'm a pretentious navel gazer because of my own words. You came empty-handed. You will leave empty-handed. What is yours today belonged to someone else yesterday and will belong to someone else the day after tomorrow. So whatever you do, do it as a dedication to God. And if you don't like the word God, do it as a dedication to something larger than yourself, somebody alive that you respect and value, or somebody passed away. This is a quote from the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, the most incredible example with a script of how to live life while also being spiritual. So that's a book everybody should get. The other book that I've recommended the Gita, and I will probably for a very long time, on the website, functionalyoga.com, on the blog section, I actually think that, oh no, it's not the blog section. It's things to hang out with. It's a tab at the top, and it has a section for books, and I think the translation that I like is up there. The other book that I'm recommending is Bring Me the Rhinoceros. My friend Denise sent this to me recently. What a fantastic book. I'm so thankful for her turning me onto it. It's by a guy named John Tarrant, who's a psychologist. And it was published in, the original was published, I think, in 2004. And then there's a new revised one that came out in 2008. And it's relatively inexpensive, but it's beautiful Zen koans. It's like based in Zen Buddhism. I think that's where he sits, but don't quote me on it. And it's fantastic. It's beautiful. Just go out, grab it, and just start reading one a day, 5 minutes a day, just to read something outside of our normal routine. John Tarrant, and he's American, and he's a teacher of Zen koans. And Zen koans are things that your mind can't figure out, so you just keep saying them over and over and over again, like what face did I have before I was born? And the mind will keep trying to wrap its head around it, and it can never be answered. Mm. So the mind is getting distracted while you are meditating, while you are cultivating the witness, while you are witnessing. And that just shows you how much of what we're doing, even though a lot of it in a practice might be Dharma talk. But it is not really about the mind. So, do you have anything you want to recommend?
Well, the book I'm currently reading is De-Stressifying Your Life by David G. I just saw his seminar, and it was fantastic. He's great. He's someone to learn about. And his book is about defining what stress is and, like you said earlier, acknowledging the 70, 80,000 thoughts a day that come in your mind and just allowing them to be and not judging them and knowing you cannot stop them, but finding a way to get in the space in between them.
Oh, yeah.
It's great. It's
so he really was great. Good? You went and did a workshop with him, right?
I did a workshop. He was personable, knowledgeable, entertaining, and it was fantastic. It was eye-opening. You know, he does a lot of examples. He teaches people that either a lot of large groups, a lot of men, interestingly enough, or women, but like the military and the criminal justice, mm-hmm. police forces around the country, and teaches them how to meditate, but he doesn't call it meditating because of the connotation that goes along with it. So
right, right.
The book is great, and he goes through all of that in the book. And
how do you spell his name?
It's called De-Stressifying Your Life.
But how do you spell his name?
Oh, David G. DAVIDJI. All one word.
Great. Oh, great. Thanks for that. I'll check that out.
Check him out. He has podcasts. He does daily meditations. If you subscribe to his website, you'll get him in your inbox. He's located in Carlsbad, California.
Oh, wow.
And his place is called The Sweet Spot.
I like that. I like that. Oh, cool. All right. Well, I'll if you send me a link for this guy and the book, I'll smack it up on Zooming in the Lens blog and also on the Functional Yoga Facebook. So great. Well, I know we got to wrap it up, but I say everybody go out there like we will and get small, average, and great. Talk Amen. To you soon. Thanks for joining Zooming in the Lens.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm on drugs. You know what it is. It's a deal, man. I love to get small. It's a wild, wild drug. Very dangerous for kids, though, because they get really small. I know I shouldn't get small when I'm driving, but I was driving around the other day. And a cop pulls me over. And he goes, "Hey, are you small?" I said, "No, I'm tall, I'm tall." He said, "Well, I'm going to have to measure you. I got a little test they gave you. It's a balloon. If you can get inside of it, they know you're small. And they can't put you in a regular cell either because you walk right out." One night I got really small, and got inside a vacuum cleaner, and the drug wore off. I retained the shape of a vacuum cleaner for about 2 weeks. Wild to get small.
Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix.com.